Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope your day's off to a wonderful start. Good to have you with us. Whether you're listening on your smart speaker at home or you're out in the world driving around listening to 89.3 or elsewhere, well, you'll find us on the FM dial throughout Southern California. Coming up next hour, we're going to be talking about some of the products that have disappeared from store shelves that might not be coming back. And we'll talk about the reasons why so many, particularly large-scale manufacturers of consumer goods, are cutting down on their product lines. We begin this hour with the latest on COVID-19. A guest who's been with us frequently over the course of these past 4.5 months from Huntington Hospital, just down the street from us here in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, good morning.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks, and certainly hope you and your colleagues at Huntington are doing well. I wanted to start with getting a sense of what's happening at the hospital in terms of patients coming in with symptoms of COVID-19 and how your intensive care units are looking.
Well, like all hospitals in L.A. County, we're certainly experiencing a fairly brisk increase in cases. But so far, we've been able to handle it. In fact, we've been taking some patients from the Inland Empire to try to help ease the burden on some of their hospitals. So we've been managing okay so far. I will tell you, the staff they're exhausted, and I think with the no end in sight option here, it's pretty discouraging. So I've been spending some time trying to give them sort of some pep talks, and they are just incredible people, the nurses and the PCAs and their RTs and the intensivist doctors, and they're exhausted, but they are just carrying on in a very amazing sort of way.
I can't imagine not just the hours, but the intensity of the work that they've been doing over such a prolonged period of time. And as you say, with no end in sight, difficult to stay mentally geared up for something that's indefinite. And I wonder if you've heard of any hospitals or maybe Huntington looking at creative ways of trying to move schedules to break it up somewhat or find ways to give people some sort of a mental break.
Yes, no, we've been trying to do that from the beginning. We have a lot of supportive services available to them. We have, we feed them when they're on their shifts. They're trying to stagger and rotate the nurses in and out so that they're not taking care of COVID patients all the time. Although many of the nurses really enjoy the work in terms of, you know, the actual challenge of it, and they're so invested in the patients. It's just an amazing sight. They're always very concerned about how they do and whether they've been discharged or how they did when they went to the intensive care unit. So we're trying to really do as many things as we can, making sure they have good PPE, listening to what their issues are with the situation. And you know, every day we learn something about this disease, we learn how to do it better, and the hospital is really making a big effort to make sure that our frontline people are protected.
Well, just to say what I know that you and others in healthcare have been hearing so much of over these past 4 months, all of us, and I feel confident speaking for all of the listeners to Air Talk, are deeply appreciative what those at your hospital, every clinic in Southern California, other first responders who are dealing with the effects of COVID-19, and of course all the other essential workers in everything from retail and food services, everyone who has been working so hard over these months, all of us deeply appreciate that.
Yes, well, it really is a collective effort. We have to pull together as society and just do the best we can to protect ourselves and to protect other people. And that's why wearing a mask is really saying to the rest of the world, I care about you as much as I care about myself. And we really want to promote that simple technique to try to get this thing under control.
Speaking of masks, one of the concerns we've heard expressed as a national issue is whether we're going to again hit a shortage of PPP and whether there are going to be enough different types of masks and equipment available in hospitals. What's your understanding of that risk?
Well, I think it's a genuine risk. And I think, it's very clear that PPE protects first responders. We want them to have the very best. We scrambled for several weeks at the beginning of this, and now just because the numbers are staggering and we're having to provide PPE for nursing facilities and so forth, it's just the supply, the demand is very high, and the supply is adequate right now, but it's always tenuous. And I think that it's so important that American manufacturing continue to step up and focus their attention on things that we can get us through this epidemic, and then we have enough resources. Governor Newsom has done a very good job at trying to make sure that we have those supplies. And, you know, for right now, we're holding on, but it's always a threat.
And, of course, PPE. I have so many acronyms running around in my head. We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist. And she's available to answer your questions about the novel coronavirus, 866-893-KPECC. You can tweet at AirTalk, post on the AirTalk Facebook page, or you can comment on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. Governor Newsom is expected at noon today in a news conference we'll carry live right here on KPECC to announce some additional restrictions. One of the things he talked about yesterday, and I don't know if this is specifically going to relate to new restrictions, are concerns over extended family gatherings. And Independence Day and this weekend that surrounds it is one of our holidays most known for extended family gatherings. It's part of the whole theme of the 4th of July. And Dr. Schreiner, any thoughts on better ways of discouraging extended families from getting together without face coverings and without having significant distance?
Well, it's very unfortunate, but it is so very dangerous to do that right now. There is tons of virus out in the community, and so many of our patients that we're taking care of now, that's exactly how they acquired it, is they went to a birthday party, they went to a barbecue. And, you know, when you're socializing, you sort of forget about things. You're glad to see your family. You're glad to see your friends. And so you really have a hard time kind of maintaining that distance. You know, I would recommend that you can certainly observe the holiday, maybe with a smaller group of people, you know, 4 to 6 people that can be more than 6 feet apart. It's best if you wear a mask during that whole event. And then you can, you know, Zoom with the other extended families, have a little Zoom session with everybody, or phone calls. There's ways of communicating that you don't have to actually be in the person's presence. And I think for this holiday, you have to do something creative, but that's safe. And the best safety is distance and wearing a mask and being outside. Those are the three best ways to prevent infection, but really limit the number of people, really not more than 4 to 5 people in an area of sort of a standard-sized yard.
Of course, one of the favorite places for extended families to gather are at Southern California beaches. Los Angeles County beaches are closed over the Independence Day weekend. Ventura County beaches are also closed over the Independence Day weekend. Laguna Beach voted to close its beach for the weekend. So you have other Orange County beaches that at this point are still open. And Dr. Schreiner, my concern would be that those beaches like Huntington and Newport are I would think are going to see huge crowds.
I fear that, Larry. I think you're right, and I just am sort of discouraged that the same hasn't been placed in Orange County. It's just so dangerous. It's the temptation is too much for people, and we know what we're experiencing right now is a lot of fallout from the Memorial Day beach expeditions. And remember that even though those beaches are in Orange County, many of the people who visit those beaches live in L.A. County, and so they're going to come right back up again and bring the disease with them. And it's just right now we have to do something different. And if you want to be a patriot, the best way to be a patriot is to protect your country, and the best way to protect your country is to try to get over this virus by practicing social distancing and wearing a mask.
All right. Dale writing on the AirTalk page, why do people take this seriously when authorities still allow protests? I can't have a family gathering, but you've got hundreds of people protesting. So let's talk about that, because Dr. Schreiner, obviously, being out protesting in a large group, being close to other people, isn't safe.
No, that's true. And I you know, the virus doesn't care what the circumstances are for the congregate situation where you have a congregation of people. They don't care if it's in a church. They don't care if it's on the street protesting. All the virus is looking for is another host. And so all of those activities certainly are super spreading events. They have the potential for being super spreaders. You know, so it's this kind of strange meeting of science and virology and the pathophysiology of this virus and social consciousness or social events. And so it's very hard to say to people, no, you can't go to your church and worship. No, you can't go on the street and voice your opinion about something. But, you know, there are other ways of doing this. You know, the best way to voice your protest is to vote. And that can be done safely. You can write to your local government people. You can stand in front of your lawn with a sign with a mask on and be silent and express your opinion. And, you know, it's hard to control emotions when such deep problems still exist in our country. And so I don't think that the officials are giving passes to protesters. It's just, you know, we know that those are potential super spreading events, and we haven't quite seen the fallout yet from the protests. That certainly could be in the next week or two.
Well, some of the increase in positive tests, wouldn't you think, would be related to that, just like some are probably related to the larger family gatherings that we know are taking a number of different causes for this?
I think that that's absolutely true. And the real fact is, Larry, is that we've had this virus in the country now for about 5 months. And it's well established in the community. And so it doesn't really care what the venue is. It's just looking for another person to infect. So if the circumstances are such that you're in a closed room, even let's say you're in a closed office space with someone for 4 or 5 hours and one person is positive, we're seeing a lot of that in doctor's offices where a staff member comes in, they're positive, they don't know they're positive. These are recorded sort of the famous asymptomatic carriers. And then the whole office gets it. So it's an opportunistic pathogen, and it just is interested in perpetuating its existence by infecting hosts, and it doesn't care what the circumstances are.
Again, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist, joining us to answer your questions. We've been providing on a daily basis an update with the latest on the science and public health measures related to COVID-19 for over 5 months now, I believe it is. We invite you to join us with your questions today at 866-893-KPECC. Michael in Monrovia says, our company is completely back to work now with everyone in the office. I'm wondering, if you're in a break room and there are some people who aren't wearing masks, are you going to be protected well enough against particles?
Well, the short answer to that is no. So I think that for companies that are doing things like that, they need to have staggered schedules where only, you know, one or two people, depending on how far you can be apart from someone. If you can be 6 feet apart in that break room, then, you know, then that's fine if it's two or three people. But there is still some risk because you, of course, don't have the mask on. And I want to remind people that the masks are to protect other people from you, but they also provide you with some protection. It's very clear there's some very good, very easy science now. You've probably seen it on the news, some of the particle images that are shown when people are talking and how many particles come out of their mouth. And then when you mask them, how many particles don't come out of their mouth. And also that the mask itself serves as a barrier to protect you a little bit from other people. So if you can't wear a mask in an area such as a lunchroom, then it needs to be, the numbers of people need to be diminished significantly, and you should stagger the schedule so that nobody's in there in too close quarters.
Speaking of face coverings, I was looking at a release from Florida Atlantic University where they did tests on different kinds of face covering materials. These were non-medical masks that they were looking at the styles, and they looked at bandanas and other sorts of things. And then they did tests of people robotic sneezes, I guess, for lack of a better term, simulate a human sneeze, and found that the quilted cotton seemed to be the one that tamped down the ejection of the spray more than other types like bandanas. Your thoughts about these kinds of simulations?
Well, I mean, they're science, and so that's always a good thing, and it does give us a general idea of what kind of products are safer than others. Some of that is, you know, the question is what's the particulate number to cause infection, and we don't really know that. It is a highly infectious pathogen, so presumably a small number of particles is adequate to cause spread. We know that in layering of masks, so for example, the quilted masks, you know, have more material between you and the outside world, so to speak, and so there's more opportunities for the mucus particles to get trapped in the material and not be spread out into the air. Some of the masks have filter inserts, and you can use simple things like vacuum cleaner bags. You cut a little filter from a vacuum cleaner bag, coffee filters you can use, any kind of additional sort of safe material. You don't want to put, you know, an asbestos thing in your mask or something. That's not a good idea. But but you want to do things that are safe, that, that increase the number of layers that the mucus has to penetrate through to diminish the transmission.
One of the things they found in this simulation is the thread count didn't matter because the bandanas had actually a higher thread count, or what you think of, you know, tighter weave, but they actually were more permeable than the quilted cotton. So that's interesting that thread count didn't seem to matter. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner with us on Air Talk, 866-893-KPECC. Eduardo in Santa Monica asks if you can clarify what it means when we hear about so many new cases. Does that mean people are testing positive, that they're symptomatic, or that they've been hospitalized?
Well, those three things or parameters are looked at all simultaneously, and they kind of reflect different things. When you test more people, you are going to detect more disease, and you may have seen some of the more recent data now that suggests our estimates of how much disease is in the United States is perhaps tenfold inaccurate. In other words, where we think we may have 2 million cases of COVID disease in the United States, we may actually have 20 million cases. So that's a very scary statistic, but I do think that there's some truth to that because we know now that it's very, very common. You can just see it in the number of people that are coming in sick into the hospital. And the hospitalizations reflect are a little bit more accurate, reflective sort of the symptomatic type of disease and also the end result of the disease. And if you figure that about 5% of people who acquire COVID may require hospitalization, 5 to 10%, it kind of depends on their age group, may require hospitalization, you can kind of go backwards and calculate how much virus is circulating in the community. But there's certainly a lot of virus out there. So new cases are detected by testing, but right now what we're looking at is the percent positive people in the number of populations, and that's more reflective of the fact that the virus is actually increasing its spread.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, will continue with her in 1 minute on Air Talk. So good to have you with us. As you just heard from Nick Roman, host of All Things Considered here on KPCC, I want to remind you, if you're not commuting anymore during the afternoon rush hour, still make sure you tune in to Nick Roman and All Things Considered. Tell your smart speaker if you're home to play KPCC, and Nick's right there with you, keeping you company every afternoon and evening right here on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. Let's see, we have Carrie in Chatsworth. Good to have you with us with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to ask her, I'm a type 1 diabetic. I read recently CDC says that type 2 diabetics are more likely to have problems. But I have to rent a room in a household with other people that I'm not related to. And I think I've heard that the actual transmission within a household is very common. What can I do to protect myself? Some of the people that rent there are not careful about who they, their friends and hanging out. And I don't know, should I wear a mask all the time? And
yeah, understandable. You're feeling vulnerable in that kind of a living situation. Dr. Schreiner?
Yeah, so I think wearing a mask when you're out outside your room, if you're in your room by yourself, then of course you don't need to wear the mask then. But if you're out in the house, it's a good idea that you wear a good quality mask, again, one that we know that's going to prevent transmission or at least decrease transmission. Again, you might want to, I don't know if you share a bathroom, but if you do, then you want to have a schedule where there's sort of some time between individuals. In other words, if somebody uses the bathroom at 9 o'clock in the morning, then maybe your hour is at 10 o'clock, so there's some downtime for that person to clean the bathroom before you get in there, and if hopefully you have tidy housemates. The same thing would be true for the kitchen areas. Any sort of areas where people are gathering are potential places for transmission, so staggering the schedule so that you don't encounter the housemates unless you want to is a good idea. And then, when of course, when you're outside of your room, wearing your mask and so forth. So that would be the best way to try to protect yourself. Diabetes in general is a risk factor for more significant disease with coronavirus, but many people with diabetes are perfectly fine and don't have a problem with this. It's just we do worry a little bit about that in that population, whether it's type 1 or type 2.
Carrie, thank you very much. Loretta in Fullerton, you're on Air Talk.
I'd like Dr. Sharner to compare and contrast the relative value of a face shield versus a face mask, since a face shield protects your eyes as well as your nose and mouth.
Plus, it's a lot more comfortable. At least that's my feeling of it, Dr. Schreiner.
Well, that is true, except that the face shield doesn't really protect the potential for aerosolized particles because, of course, they can slip underneath the face shield itself. So if you're not wearing a mask under the face shield, it's not as effective as wearing a mask without a face shield, truthfully. A mask is more protective in terms of the really essential port of entry, if you will, of the virus, which are the nasal mucous membranes in the mouth. The face shield is good to protect your eyes and splashes and so forth. And so it is, ideally, if you're doing, for example, our nurses that are taking care of these patients or doing testing, they wear a face shield and a mask at the same time. I wouldn't recommend that they don't wear a mask underneath the face shield because that there's no protection in the area underneath the face shield that so it could allow potentially aerosolized particles to get up underneath there and get into your nasal mucosa, which is the most dangerous area.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Abby asks on Facebook, I haven't exhibited any symptoms, but I'm interested in getting tested just for peace of mind. Do COVID-19 test results include whether antibodies are present? And if you have antibodies, does that mean you could still be infected or contagious and would have to self-quarantine for 14 days?
So those are two different tests. The test to see if you have active disease is what's called a molecular test or a PCR. You can get those tests even if you're asymptomatic. The testing capabilities right now are being a little bit difficult to obtain. So we're trying to kind of encourage people that either have had an exposure or who are symptomatic to be the ones that get tested. But asymptomatic people can be tested, and that's a nasopharyngeal swab. Down the nose. It's not very comfortable, but it's a very accurate test to see if you're actually shedding virus, and that would reflect the fact that you have the disease and that you're infectious. The serologies are antibody testings are a different test. That's a blood test, and that is not done routinely. And doesn't have any help in terms of determining your infectivity. It may reflect that you had coronavirus, perhaps you didn't know it, and you had it, so you have positive antibodies. But it doesn't. It probably doesn't have any relevance in terms of your infectivity. Unfortunately, we have seen a few people who have had a positive PCR test, which means they're shedding virus and their serologies are positive. So there's probably an overlap period that occurs after people are recovering from the disease where they've developed enough antibodies that it's detected on the serology test. But that's a blood test. And again, doesn't reflect really infectivity at all.
You were mentioning about the challenge with testing. Why is it with the huge expansion of testing capacity that it looks like we may be encountering shortages again?
Well, because the numbers of people that we have to test right now, it's just purely a numbers game. And you know, the testing is dependent on several things. First of all, venues where you can do good testing with staff that are protected and know how to do it effectively. If somebody does a nasopharyngeal swab inaccurately, it may give you a false negative test, and then that's of no utility. So these testing sites have to have personnel that know how to do it properly, and they'll be, of course, wearing full PPE to do those tests. The second piece is then you have to have the supply chain for the instrument with which you're doing the test. So in the case of most drive-up testing or office testing, it's a nasopharyngeal swab. Those have periodically been in short supply and get backlogged, and there's a problem there. Then the test has to go to the testing site, the laboratory that's doing the test, and there are special reagents and machines that are used to process that testing, and the reagents can sometimes be in short supply. And at any one time, any one of those pieces could be backed up because there's just too much demand and not enough supply. And so then there's a delay in testing. And that's what's happened, unfortunately, when you have just the huge surges that we're seeing here in California and around the country, truthfully.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Michael in Monrovia asks, if my mom wants to hold my 11-month-old baby and she's wearing a mask, washes her hands right before, would that be effective in preventing spread to the baby?
It certainly would decrease the likelihood that spread to the baby. Of course, if your mom has been sheltering in place at home and hasn't been out, or even perhaps if she's had a test herself and doesn't exhibit any symptoms, then it's unlikely that she has the virus, and so that also would be a part of your decision-making. You know, there's no risk-free activity with this disease. It is always possible that somebody somehow managed to acquire the disease, but the vast majority of people know where they got it or are symptomatic, and so if your mom's washing her hands, wearing a mask, she's been at home and doesn't have any exposures, then it's probably safe that she can hold her grandchild.
All right. Let's take another listener question. This is from Tall, wondering the relative effectiveness of N95, KN95s, and surgical masks.
So the best mask is the N95 mask. That's able to filter out particles that are less than 10 microns, and that's what this virus is. It's a teeny tiny little particle, and those are what we wear for the high-risk procedures in the hospital. What the nurses wear when they're taking care of these patients, what the doctors wear. When I go in a room, I have an N95 on. So those masks are the best. The KN95s are probably adequate enough for the vast majority of situations. They're not quite as tried and true as those classic N95 masks. Some of the masks have to be fitted. They really have to fit you very well and tightly against your face. That's why you see all these healthcare workers with sores on their noses or scars on their faces from wearing the mask for 12 hours. They're quite uncomfortable. They're very tight-fitting, and there's a piece of metal across the bridge of the nose. But the KN95s are okay, but they're not perfect. The surgical masks are fine for sort of daily activities, but not high-risk activities for a healthcare worker. And so surgical masks, kind of flop around on your face a little bit, and they're potential areas for contamination. So they're fine for out in the public. They're fine for the nurses working on the offices or sitting on the floor away from the patients. But N95s are the gold standard.
And we know surgical masks are single use. How is that defined? I've never quite understood. Does that mean you go out for half an hour and that's it? You got to toss it, or could you use it for a full day, taking it on and off? How long do the surgical mask last?
Well, I mean, if you want to, you know, if you're just out going grocery shopping or something, well, I don't think I would do it then either, actually. It's probably better. They're very inexpensive, and it's probably better to change out a fresh mask. The problem is the outside of it can get contaminated. So you're wearing it to protect yourself. Let's say you go to the grocery store, and you happen to be over in the vegetable section, and somebody coughs, and maybe, just maybe, some particles fly through the air and land on the outside of the mask. That mask is now contaminated. And so it's probably better to go ahead and just put in a clean mask. You know, a mask for the day is reasonable if you're really just out walking down the street and you're not really having any kind of close encounters with people. Then, you know, you can probably take it down while you're taking a drink of water and put it back up again, and it's not a big deal. They're fragile, and they don't last very long. You can't wash them, of course. The cloth masks you can wash and reuse, so that's sort of the difference with the two. But surgical masks now, you can buy them on Amazon. You can buy them in the supermarkets. They thankfully haven't been in short supply.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner joining us from Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. One of the things we've been hearing about testing is that some of the labs to get quicker results are pooling them. So you can explain, I'm sure, better than I can, but essentially you take multiple tests and you see if you get a positive out of them. If you do, then you work down from there. Is there any risk of missing positives when you pool like that?
Well, there is a risk. Pooling is a very good idea, and it's an interesting idea. It's an epidemiologic tool, and you're exactly right, Larry. If you have, let's say you have 100 people that you test, what you do is you break them up into whatever number of groups. You put them in 5 groups, so you have 20 in each group. And then you test that group as a group rather than as an individual. So you only have to do one test. You have to do 5 tests instead of 100 tests. then if you identify that one of those groups is positive, then you can dive down more deeply. You know who's in that group. You call them back and you get them tested and you find out who the culprit is in that department. That's dependent on the fact that the disease is not very prevalent in the population. When the disease increases in prevalence, when it gets above maybe, and we don't really know what that cutoff is, but when it gets above maybe 15 or 20%, then it's the pooling doesn't save you anything because every pool is going to be positive, and you have to go back and test everybody again anyway. So if the disease is less, somewhere around 10 to 14% or less, then pooling is one way of saving testing kits and getting a good idea sort of how much disease is circulating. It's fairly easy to do. There's different ways of doing testing that are more complicated, different kinds of molecular assays you can do to test that pool. But it's best when, you know, right now would be fine. We don't think it's at 20% in our community, but it's probably somewhere around 5 to 9%, just grossly looking at some of the data. And so pooling is a reasonable thing to do to try to save the number of testings that you're doing.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital. Neil in Altadena says there are estimates number of people infected actually much higher because of underreporting. Is there any solace that the number of positive cases is likely much higher when looking at the ratio between cases and the number of people who have died? I feel like that should be considered.
Yes, that's an excellent observation. And, you know, thank you, Neil, for one little note of positivity in an otherwise dark situation, although mortality is certainly a dark event. But that does provide some solace that the virus, when the number of people tested and who are positive increases, when the denominator increases and the numerator stays the same because that's just the number of deaths, then that means that the virus is, the mortality associated with this virus is not perhaps as horrible as we think it is. Now, the only problem with that is that you have to look at individual populations. So the mortality, for example, in 20-year-olds is probably somewhere around 0.5 to 0.8%. The mortality in 70-year-olds maybe 3 or 4 or 5%. So it depends a little bit on the population that you're looking at, but you're absolutely right. You increase the number of people tested positive, that's the denominator, and then you calculate your percent mortality, which is the number of people who've died over the total number of people who are positive, and that number is going to get smaller as the number of positive cases increase.
So we could be seeing, though, at least in part, the fact that many more younger people are getting tested now.
Yes, I think more young people are getting tested, which is a great thing. We want people to get tested. But if you want to look at the actual mortality, the general population mortality, then that's going to be everybody who's included in those positive tests. But you do have to sort of think about certain populations. If you look at the mortality in that population, that's more meaningful as a clinician when a patient comes into the hospital. Well, this person's 60 years old, so their mortality is different than somebody who's 20 years old, and you know that makes a difference in terms of management.
We thank you again, Dr. Schreiner, so generous with your time, and just love hearing from you, even with what's some difficult information for us to take in at times. Just as you say, with no end to the pandemic in sight, it's challenging for us, but you certainly help us get a better understanding, and we appreciate it very much.
Well, it's my pleasure, Larry. Your service is wonderful, and I just really want to reach out to everybody. Please, please, please wear a mask and stay safe. Over the 4th of July, small groups of people, good social distancing, wear a mask. That's how you can be a patriot.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner with us from Huntington Hospital. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk with the chief of infectious diseases at City of Hope National Medical Center in Duarte. We'll find out what Dr. Sanjeet Dadwal has to say about the latest on COVID-19, and we'll take more of your questions at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 90 seconds. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Just a quick reminder, coming up in our next hour, we're going to be talking about the potential for Los Angeles County mental health employees and homeless services workers to be able to respond to some of the 911 calls for service that involve homelessness or mental health challenges. That's coming up next hour on Air Talk right here on KPCC. We welcome to our conversation about COVID-19 from the City of Hope National Medical Center in Duarte in the East San Gabriel Valley, the Chief of Infectious Diseases, Dr. Sanjeet Dadwal. Thank you very much, Dr. Dadwal, for joining us on Air Talk. Let me start, first of all, with looking at the increasing numbers of positive tests that we're seeing, but hospitals still being able to handle the cases coming in. To what degree are you concerned about Southern California hospitals and ICUs being able to handle surges?
Hi, Larry. First of all, thank you so much for having me on your show. This is a valid concern. I'm saying in the last week or so, we've seen sudden surge in the number of cases, and that basically indicates widespread transmission within the community, and that translates into hospital visits, which means emergency room visits, hospitalization, who are critically ill, and especially when you look at different components of our society. I'm saying older patients, those with comorbidities, which I mean they have other diseases like diabetes, heart failure, cancer, chemotherapy patients. This virus trickles from the community to them also. They're not immune to that, and they tend to have more severe disease, which then translates into hospital occupancy. So, yes, if the numbers continue as they grow, as they are growing, there is a concern that the hospitals could again be overrun by a large number of patients.
We have a listener question from Reinhold in Brea. She says, I'm scheduled for a mammogram. What kind of mask should the technician be wearing? What kind of mask should I wear?
Well, as far as, we define infection risk for different population of patients in different scenarios for different procedures, the best thing to have is a face mask of any kind. So even a plain surgical mask will work, and the healthcare worker wears it, and the patient wears it, and they get the mammogram done. That should be safe enough.
All right.
And the transmission dramatically.
When I had to go to the dentist, and when I went, I wore my cotton face covering. But the dentist's office, they were totally decked out in PPE. They had in addition to N95 surgical mask, face shield. So, you know, any of these folks that are dealing with the public presumably are because they're at greater risk than the patient is, right? They're seeing people all day. Presumably, they're going to be taking significant precautions.
That is correct. It's the time of exposure to a particular individual or a patient who has a different set of risk of infection from the community as to what we do in the community. If I am the patient and I was at the, at a common communal setting where there were five other people and not wearing my mask, and then I go for my dental work, that doctor doesn't know where the patient has been in the last few days, so they have to take full precautions, although sometimes they can be an overkill. So you just need a mask and you need your goggles or a face shield to protect yourself when you're doing work. And obviously when you're doing procedures where they are higher risk to the healthcare worker, they will be using an N95 mask.
Crystal asks on the page, AirTalk page at kpecc.org, are those who test positive or hospitalized asked about their presence at protests? If so, what are they asked? It was offensive to hear the governor say that larger family gatherings aren't going to be allowed when nothing similar said about the large gatherings 2 to 3 weeks ago. I mean, this has been a theme on a daily basis on this program, how it appears that any sort of information gathering about people's potential exposures to the coronavirus, that information does not seem to be gathered in real time. And Dr. Dadwal, I don't understand why we're not gathering this kind of information to determine comparative risk of activities.
So, when we do see a patient who has coronavirus infection, there are set questions which are asked, because in any healthcare facility, so our center is dealing with cancer patients, so we are very cautious as to where you've been, who you got exposed to, who traveled to your house, whether they had a travel history, to get a sort of sense what the transmission is or where it is from, for a larger community, I'm saying it really falls under the purview of public health department for that contact tracing. How did it happen? In what context did it happen? And learn more so that that kind of transmission can be halted.
And it's you know, I say this every day, but it's just a glaring hole that we don't have information about the likeliest source of transmission for people that test positive, and particularly for people who become sickest and are in hospital. Seems like, you know, the closest we get is age, some racial and ethnic data. Even that's incomplete because a high percentage of people don't report that. And whether they were in an institutional setting like a skilled nursing facility, assisted living, et cetera. But to get down, you know, more detailed information about transmission, again, you know, we're just sitting here without that. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're looking forward to your questions for Dr. Sanjit Datwal of City of Hope National Medical Center. Dan in North Hollywood wondering, can you reuse an N95 mask if you're not using it in a medical setting? And if you let it sit for a few days between uses, doctor?
It could be used, but there's a caution. If it looks soiled or it becomes wet, then obviously it's going to lose its efficiency.
Okay, so and do we know how many days and airings it might last, or is that uncertain?
Well, it's difficult to state, to be honest with you.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We have a question about types of N95 masks, because they're made by all different manufacturers. Are they all submitted for some sort of testing here in the United States? Wondering if one brands are better than another's. Dr. Datwal?
So N95 means that the mask is filtering out 95% of the particulate matter. And there are standards, and those have to be passed. And the main thing about the different types of N95 is what fits a person the best. So in the healthcare facilities where you have healthcare workers, they actually undergo what we call as fit testing, make sure that that's doing what it's supposed to do, although in the community that doesn't happen. But if you're buying an N95, which is through the United States, within our country, it has to be approved through certain metrics.
All right. So there is approval. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can ask your questions of City of Hope National Medical Center Chief of Infectious Diseases, Dr. Sanjit Datwal, at 866-893-KPECC. Daniel asks, if people are found to have cells that destroy the virus, in other words, immunity, would officials disclose those cases to the public? If natural immunity is possible, would a vaccine be counterproductive and ultimately harmful?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And at City of Hope, we do vaccine trials. And what we have learned from past also, that when you do have a vaccine in somebody who's been infected previously, there's something known as, it's an enhancement of the immune response. That is something which the clinical trials will give us the answer.
All right, we'll continue with City of Hope National Medical Center Infectious Disease, head of that division, Dr. Sanjit Datwal. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, also on the KPECC app and at kpecc.org. We're talking with City of Hope National Medical Center physician Dr. Sanjit Datwal, who chairs the Division of Infectious Diseases. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Sasha in Boyle Heights says, my mom has a trip planned to come from New York to Los Angeles. How safe do you think air travel is, Dr. Datwal?
Well, I would say this, that if the travel is necessary, absolutely necessary, you got to do it, you do it. But if the travel is unnecessary, it's best to avoid. You're going to be in a close and close space, even though airlines are making all efforts for physical distancing, there's always going to be a potential risk of acquisition of the virus.
And one other thing to keep in mind, because now the quarantine that New York has issued for people coming from California, whenever she goes back to New York, then she'll be expected to comply with a 14-day quarantine.
That is correct.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's see. Iban writes, what are the ramifications if your mask becomes damp while being worn, sweating or saliva or anything? Does that affect its ability to protect others?
That is absolutely correct. When the mask becomes damp, it's not able to function as it should be, and that is the time when the mask needs to be changed.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. Diane in West L.A. said, I understand that Hong Kong is doing a very good job handling the coronavirus. I'm wondering, you know, what's happened there, and wondering, is it about, you know, such a high percentage of people wearing masks?
So that's a very good question, and this is a question which folks always ask, that some countries are doing better than others. I think at the root cause of everything is, how early do you act? How quickly do you act? How kind of tracing capabilities a particular community or country has? And then the collective responsibility of all citizens following the recommendations of public health departments, or in our case, CDC. Masking is important. Physical distancing is important. Those are two easy things which can be done and can really be dramatically helpful.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. Gail in Ojai says, my health club just opened the pool. We can go there to swim, but I'm uneasy about it. We have to touch railings and doors. What do you think about swimming in public pools?
Well, I'm safe. Some folks believe it's okay, but again, when you have a high community transmission going on where there's high touch frequency of doorknobs, railings, other things, so it may not be the water itself, but it is the proximity to other people who are not wearing masks, I doubt that somebody's going to be able to swim with a mask on. And if there are multiple people in the swimming pool and when they are above the water, they are breathing, and there's a risk for transmission if somebody is, let's say, pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic shedder.
We have Jeannie on Twitter tweeting at AirTalk, says, if someone in public is not wearing a mask, they get within 6 feet of us, what are the chances of contracting the virus from them if they have COVID-19?
Well, I'm saying if you're not going to be in contact with them for a specified period of time, if you're just walking by on a footpath for your morning walk, that should not be an issue as you pass by. You're not in that zone where you're continuously exposed to that person. So there has to be a close contact and a consistent exposure time where you start getting at risk of contracting it.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Derek in Fullerton, good to have you with us. Your question for Dr. Sanjit Dedwal.
Hi, thank you so much. We're currently negotiating for our school district the learning conditions for our students, and one model that they're considering is an AM, PM, where like half the kids come in the morning, there's like an hour break in between, and then the second group comes. So my question is more about not so much the sanitizing of surfaces, but the air exchange, like leaving a couple doors open would suffice?
Well, that's a very good question. I would say, you know, within the close buildings, within hospitals, you have air exchanges which have to happen. So coming to schools, I would say obviously they may not have the same level of technical capabilities of air exchanges, but having windows open, doors open, having kids physically distanced, and the other big question is, will they wear the mask? Those are all important points, yes.
But do we, is much of this on the air exchange related to the quality of the school's HVAC system? Is that a significant part of this?
Well, I think that will be a unique situation for each school district or school to determine what that status is. But not knowing that, the best thing is if you have open air circulation and the kids have to go to school, then having windows and doors open would make perfect sense.
All right, Derek, we wish you the best. I'm sure it's very difficult working through this whole process because you're kind of flying half blind here and figuring this out for school districts, how they're going to deal with it. I know all of them just, it's a big challenge. What percentage of students do you have come back, and how many days do they come back, and how do you protect teachers and other staff members from the spread? And, Dr. Detwaller, you concerned about, all these challenges that the schools are facing come fall?
These are very challenging situations. I myself have a 9-year-old kid who's going to go back to fourth grade, and I'm already seeing his side of things, not being able to socialize with his friends and how they do it over the web, playing video games, trying to talk to each other, and they need their own social circle, and it's going to be very difficult, and it is going to be challenging, but I think we will go through this with guidance from our public health folks, having some sensible rules and regulations placed, and also having some compliance from the parents as well as from the school.
Thank you, Dr. Detwall. We appreciate it so much. Thank you for joining us and sharing your expertise with us about the latest on COVID-19 public health measures to try and contain the spread of it. Thank you very much.
Very welcome. Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you so much. From City of Hope National Medical Center in Duarte, Chief of Infectious Diseases, Dr. Sanjeet Detwall. We remind you, coming up at noon today, Governor Gavin Newsom, it's anticipated that he's going to be sharing some new restrictions related to the increasing number of cases of COVID-19.